Edinburgh and Lothian's Pensioners for Indie Group invited Craig DL, who's head of research at Commonweal Think Tank, to talk to them. How can Scotland best respond to the current crises facing us, well, facing the world, to COVID, to the climate emergency, to Brexit cliff edge? Is our economy resilient enough to mitigate and adapt to let us overcome those challenges? The Commonweal Think Tank says a very loud yes to that question, and they've got a plan for a resilient Scotland. The talk is about 25 minutes long, and then there's a very lively question and answer session, including questions like, we could close INEOS at Grangemouth, but how do we replace those 10,000 jobs? How do the numbers of jobs lost in this pandemic compare to the jobs you think might be gained in green jobs for the future? How can we get a proper set of fiscal accounts for Scotland? So that question was asked just a couple of weeks before the latest GERS figures came out. Quite a few questions about how can we best share Commonweal ideas with the wider population, since of course mainstream media don't really do that. How can we have a younger generation who's well informed about civil politics, basic economics, Scottish history and philosophy? How does Commonweal get access to MSPs and the Scottish Government to persuade them about their policies? Actually, to that one, Craig suggests a more important question is how do constituents get access to MSPs, because that's where the power lies. The power lies with us. So here's a talk, and we hope you enjoy it.
And welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us today. And a particular thank you to Craig from Commonweal for coming to speak to us today. Many of you will have heard Craig speaking before, and I'm sure lots of you have read the work that Commonweal have done. Really fantastic, forward-looking, and very impressed with what they do. Craig, just for the recording, can you please confirm that you do know this is being recorded and you're okay with that?
Absolutely fine with that. Thank you. Oh, hi, folks. Thank you for coming out coming to talk this. I have really enjoyed doing these virtual public talks. Looking forward to doing a few more in person when it's safe to do so. But until then, and even after then, I have to say it's been great seeing the outreach that you can get through this technology. Today, I'm going to be talking about one of Commonweal's latest projects. We've called it the Resilient Scotland Plan. It is essentially a synthesis of everything we have done for the last 6 years since we founded as a think tank. We recognised that when the pandemic hit, we started to see what we would need to do to come back out the other end and to start rebuilding the economy, and to rebuild it in a way that actually took us to a better place rather than just going back to the economy that we knew wasn't working before. So we started looking at things like our Green New Deal plan, our plan for an investment-led economy, for local democracy, and for well-being economy, for all these other concepts and buzzwords that you've seen, and we synthesised it all together into a coherent plan, a 25-year plan for Scotland. As a bit of a background, we've recognised over the last 20-odd years that a lot of places the economy hasn't been working. In 1997, Gordon Brown promised the end of boom and bust, and since then we've had three. Every time the economy falls over, we pick it back up and we try to repair what happened, but often we don't think about what has gone beyond that. So the 2008 financial crash, for instance, we picked up the banks and we fixed them, and it's probably no coincidence that the banks have so far survived a lot better through this crisis than they did in 2008. The fixes we put in place over a decade ago have helped them, but we didn't fix the things beyond them. So the rest of the economy just waited for the next crash, and here we are. If we think of recessions and crises as a bit like a tide, the tide comes in, washes away all of our sandcastles, it goes out again and we rebuild it. We have to think about the coming crisis, the climate emergency, because it's not going to be like a tide. It's going to be more like sea level rise. It's going to be more like the sea comes in, covers up our beach. It doesn't go back out again. The climate emergency threatens to permanently reduce the carrying capacity of the planet and our ability to have an economy, a society, a civilization. So coming out of this crisis, we need to think about what we need to do as an economy, as a country, to help avoid the worst of the climate emergency, but also to make ourselves resilient to the impacts, the negative effects that are coming thanks to the inaction that has happened before. We saw in the news this week that a tipping point has already been reached, that even if we stopped producing CO2 today, the Greenland ice sheets are still going to melt. They've already passed a point of no return. So the negative impacts of climate change are coming. It's now about damage limitation. Now, we published in 2019 our vision of a Green New Deal, of what Scotland can do. It's so far the only fully costed plan for a Green New Deal for any country in the world. For our resilience project, we thought we had to look at what that actually means for an economy. So we produced the first paper, which was a theoretical paper, an underpinning for our work. We called it Resilience Economics. Rather than going for free market economics or socialist economics, this is resilience economics. So we took economic theories and models from various parts of economics and distilled them down into this framework. We said that, what does resilience mean for an economy? The economy shouldn't collapse the way it does and has in previous recessions. It shouldn't hopefully collapse at all. We shouldn't be encouraging the boom and bust cycle. It also means social resilience. Too often, when there is a crash, the negative economic impacts land on those least able to cope, and the bailouts end up going for the folk who least need them. And it means environmental resilience, because it doesn't matter how much wealth we generate for the shareholders if we kill the planet in the process. They need to breathe cleaner too. So what does resilience economy look like? Well, it means sufficiency and security. It means that we look at an economy and we look at, does everybody have enough of what they need to have a comfortable life? And security, can we be sure that everyone will have it tomorrow? If you're working an insecure job on a 0 hours contract, you don't know if you can pay the rent tomorrow. That's not a secure economy for you. It means well-being. What is the purpose of our economy? Is it there to make us happier and healthier and, you know, live our lives better? Or is it just there to make us richer but miserable? Or just a few of us richer and the rest of us miserable? It means cooperation. One thing this pandemic has shown, that the solutions are rooted in what society does collectively. If we were all trying to prevent the pandemic as isolated individuals, then it wouldn't work. We'd all be shielded in a basement somewhere, and we wouldn't even have a food box coming in to help us. It means diversity. Scotland, to a degree, is. I mean, it's generally quite a broad-based society economy. But if you think about what are our key exports, I mean, there's three that people mention: oil, salmon, whiskey. And those three things are not exactly very good for the economy, for the environment. You know, we know the environmental damage of oil and the climate effects it's having. We know the devastating social impacts of alcohol consumption. And if you want to really look at the local environmental problems of salmon farming, that's worth a documentary in itself. Resilience also means participation. It means an economy that is built for everyone, not just by a few people who can then skim off all the wealth from it. It means transparency. If you can see where the public contracts are going, then you can determine if they're going into the right places or not. It means opportunity. You know, if you are resigned to your lot in life, if you are in your place and you know you can't ever leave it, then is that better than feudalism, really? And it means decentralisation, because one thing that is crucial, this cannot be a top-down process. You cannot go to a community and say, this is the economy we are designing for you. It must be built by everyone. So if we've got those principles, how do you measure your economy to make sure it's working? Well, you measure things like sufficiency, usefulness, extraction rate, waste creation rate, circularity. One example in those three. What is the thing that typifies the throwaway economy best? I would say a disposable plastic cup. You have to extract oil to create it. You use it once and you throw it away. very wasteful way of running an economy. You'll notice in that list of metrics for the economy, there's one missing: GDP growth. This is the metric that everybody focuses on. You see it all the time in economy ministers, and even when they try and salve you with things like inclusive growth or green growth or sustainable growth. That growth-based economy is not sustainable. It's not green. It's usually not inclusive either. Under the resilience economics model, you know, growth might happen as we make the economy, you know, better, more well-being, more circular, but it shouldn't be the point. We shouldn't be chasing growth. We'll see in the JERS report tomorrow, you know, how the National Accounts of Scotland, we'll see a line in there about how much the Scottish economy has grown or shrunk in the last year. But we shouldn't be using this as a metric of the success of the economy. So that's the principles. Once we published that, we then published three papers that outlined a blueprint that would take us from where we are right now today out to 2045, when Scotland would be a carbon neutral Green New Deal country. The first one recognises that we are in a pandemic, and to get out of it, we need to take certain steps right now. We need to try and protect parts of the economy that we're going to need. And you know, we have to recognise that we do have an election coming up next year as well. So the first part of the plan takes us from right now, ending lockdown, and takes us to the Holyrood elections. The second part of the plan then looks at the 2021 Parliament, and looks at all the things that Scotland can do with the powers that we have under the current devolution settlement. Because one of the things that's often thrown at us is by opponents of independence is, well, why do you want independence? Why do you want more powers? You haven't used the powers that you've got. Well, if we implement this plan, we will. We will be pushing the boundary. And then the third part of the plan, we'll assume that by the end of the next Parliament, we will be an independent country, and we will have all of the powers to finish the plan. So part one, post-lockdown till the Holyrood elections. Right now, we're on the cusp of seeing if Scotland's going into a second spike in COVID cases. It's getting a bit worrying. I'm writing a paper at the moment on what we can do to try and prevent that. We need to end lockdown safely. We need to deploy a test, trace, isolate and support strategy that will actually keep us safe. We have a paper called Ending Lockdown that shows how Scotland can do it. We've estimated that spending £1.5 billion on lockdown measures now would save us around £15 billion. That would be the cost of a second wave and a second national lockdown. From then, we start rebuilding the economy. There are areas, I say, that are reserved, and we do need things like more borrowing powers for the Scottish Parliament, but there are still areas that we could look at. We need more borrowing powers. We need the restrictions on how Scotland can borrow to be lifted. The Scottish Government then needs to lift the borrowing restrictions that are applied to local authorities, because a lot of this needs to be run by local authority level, and local authorities are just as restricted by the Scottish Government as the Scottish Government is by Westminster. We're going to have a Scottish National Investment Bank by the end of this year. It currently can only spend the money that it is given by the Scottish Government. That needs to be a restriction that's lifted. The Westminster Government and the Treasury can lift that restriction. The moment that it can do so, the SNB can start issuing bonds, it can start having things like pension funds invest directly in it, and it can use that money to start investing in Scotland. We do have certain measures in there as well. So it's very likely that very few of us will be travelling for tourism in the near future, and those that do, we're probably going to be travelling less. But we do need to support the tourism industry. So we've recommended a £100 voucher for every person in Scotland to go and take a holiday somewhere in Scotland. Give people a chance to see our own country for a change. We put that out and we thought, are we being a bit too generous with this? And then other countries have come out with schemes that are even more generous than this one. Actually, maybe I'll be falling behind a wee bit. But fact is, Scotland still hasn't done it, so there is still a potential for something like this to happen. We also want to see a voucher given to everyone to be spent in in independent restaurants. The UK government has the 50% off voucher that can be spent a lot of places, but a lot of those places are already multinational companies. And we want to focus on a bit more on local wealth building. So rather than going to your nearby chain takeout place, why not go and visit your local cafe, your local restaurant? We want to bring in a basic income for artists to sustain people who can't earn a living because all of the art venues, all the galleries, all the arenas and theatres are all closed down. But once it is safe to start reopening places like that, then we want to organise a Festival of Scotland. We also recognise that people are struggling in their houses when they're on furlough or out of work or when places are closing. So we've also got schemes to protect homeowners and renters through things like a mortgage to public rent scheme and other measures. And as we start rebuilding, we need to have an urgent reform of the way that procurement happens. We cannot go back to the old system of PFI and its descendants. And we need to make sure that public money remains in Scotland rather than going to overseas tax havens. The Scottish Government did recently pass an amendment to one of the bills that said that no public money would go to companies that use tax havens. But the Scottish Government, the SNP, also voted against a measure called country-by-country reporting, which would have forced multinational companies operating in Scotland to show how much money they are taking out of Scotland and hiding in tax havens. So that needs to be corrected. If we do this, then we can start looking forward to the future where we can start really improving supply chains covering everything from food, materials, energy, housing, you name it. So that takes us up to the elections. We get to 2021, and at that point we recognise that in 2018 we were told we had 12 years left to make serious changes to our economy if we wanted to avert the worst impacts of climate change. We're now almost 3 years, by the time of the election we'll be almost 3 years away from that paper, that announcement. We're running out of time, so we need to start building that Green New Deal. We cannot wait until the 2041 election to decide that, oh, we have a 2045 target that we need to meet. Yes, the Scottish Parliament doesn't have all the powers that we have, but what we should do is look at our Green New Deal plan, identify all of the areas that can be done and start doing them. All the areas that cannot be done, take them as close to shovel ready as possible. For example, you need a new building to do some kind of scheme, and current restrictions, current powers stop you from building that building, then at least identify where it needs to be. So if energy is reserved and we can't build all the energy infrastructure we need, then let's start doing the surveys to find out where are the best places to put solar panels, where are the best places to start building geothermal plants if that's what we need. If we can't build them now, get it as close to the point that we can. We build on the previous principles, start building up all those supply chains that we need to start really kick-starting that renewables economy. We shouldn't be importing wind turbines from halfway around the world. We should be building them here. And the same goes for a lot of renewable technology, a lot of technology for the Green New Deal. Scotland doesn't even produce anywhere near enough cellulose, wood-based cellulose house insulation to meet our needs to insulate the houses that we'll need to improve for the Green New Deal. We should be starting to produce that. We've recommended that we set up a diversification agency to look at the vulnerabilities in the Scottish economy. Where are the areas that could fall down if there's another crash, if there's another pandemic, if there's another whatever, and start to put in measures to protect the Scottish economy from those impacts. We need a retraining agency because there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be out of work because their job has been made obsolete by the pandemic. That can go from anywhere from office workers who no longer need to go to the office, whose companies have reprofiled and found that they can work more efficiently and don't need so many people. It also means possibly the folk who service those offices that are now lying empty because everybody's working from home. it will mean people working in the fossil fuel industry who will need to be retrained and possibly diverted into the renewable energy industry. There's great potential there. Folk with Friends of the Earth have produced papers on this. The number of jobs that Scotland could produce in the offshore renewable industry dwarfs the number of jobs that are currently employed in the oil industry. And the joke I like to make is, if Scotland ever runs out of wind, we've got bigger problems than budget cuts. We need to decentralise. Scotland is one of the most centralised countries. Scotland doesn't have a local democracy. We have a regional democracy. Everywhere in Europe has municipal councils and town councils. We don't. We need to reprofile our financial sector, create a public retail bank to strengthen local economies, rather than getting another bad headline of another multinational bank moving out of Scotland. At least we won't have the problem of RBS moving out of Scotland at the next India FA. They've already gone. We need to democratise. We need more citizens' assemblies. We need to overhaul freedom of information laws. We need a better statistics agency. We need a national news agency. We have plans in this for a fund to train up more journalists in Scotland. One of the things that I was horrified to see come from the Scottish Government was their response to the Benny Higgins economic recovery report, where the Scottish Government said that they wanted to increase secondments into the civil service from the business sector. That's the exact opposite of what we need to do. We need to ban that. We need to set up policy academies to teach policy development skills. This is one of my great goals in Scottish politics. So one thing we often almost celebrate in Scotland is the weakness of the political opposition compared to the government. I think that's a horrible thing, because our government only needs to be one vote better than its opposition. If the opposition is weak, the government can get lazy. So I think we need all political parties to start upping their game in policy development. And that also kind of goes into the civil service as well, and how do we teach policy implementation. If we can do that, then we can replace a lot of these closed-door lobby groups and consultancies, you know, passing ready-made roadmaps to the government. That would include us, but we don't get behind the door. As I say, we need to start everything we can in the Green New Deal plan and scope out everything that we can't. And that should take us to near the end of the Parliament. By 2024, we should have a lot of that up and running. We'll have met the unionist challenge that we have used the powers of devolution. We can then go to the Scottish people and say, if you want us to carry on, we have done everything that we can within our powers. If you want us to carry on, we need the powers of an independent country. So by or before 2024, there should be a referendum or a democratic event to ask the Scottish people what we do next. Become an independent country and carry on the plan, or stay within the union, scrap everything that we've done up to that point, go over to the UK government and say, it's on you now. We've done everything we can. The people of Scotland obviously don't want it. What's your offer instead? Assuming we vote for independence and we become an independent nation, then we start the 20-year plan. All those shovel-ready projects that we scoped out can begin. And then we just do it. Put the shovel to the dirt and start doing things. By or before 2045, Scotland will be a carbon neutral country, a carbon negative country if things go well, even better. We'll have achieved all the other sustainability goals demanded of a Green New Deal. In our plan, we have estimated that it would take around £175 billion spent over those 25 years to achieve that goal. We've also estimated that if we borrow that money and repay it over 50 years, then it would cost us around £5 billion a year. Sounds like a huge sum. But we've also estimated that the act of implementing this Green New Deal would generate over £6.5 billion a year in tax revenue and profits from nationalised industries. So this Green New Deal plan actually won't cost Scotland anything, actually earns us money. With that in mind, a political failure to not do it. So let's fast forward, let's look at 2045. What's changed? Our quality of life is better. We're now all working a four-day week. We have a culture of borrowing and leasing instead of buying the next new shiny gadget every time one comes out. We're working less. We've got more time to enjoy life. We're working closer to home. I'm now going to be working from home more or less permanently, which I love because I'm not having to deal with the morning commute anymore. We actually get to embed in our community and be a part of our community rather than just be someone who comes back at night to sleep between shifts. Our healthcare improves. We'll have a national pharmaceutical company and a national care service that will work with and strengthen the NHS. We'll have less pollution and other damaging effects of our current wasteful economy, so we'll have less need of healthcare. We'll be a happier, healthier nation. We will be less unequal, and we won't see the multi-billionaires sitting on their massive dragon hordes, keeping that wealth from productive use that the rest of us could require, enjoy. And we'll have a tax system that actually works for the well-being and benefit of the people of Scotland, not for economic growth and pandering to tax avoiders. It is obviously somewhat speculative. You know, you can't sit here in 2020 and say exactly what life in 2045 would be like. Imagine sitting in 1995 and projecting now, telling people, oh, you'll be sitting locked at home because of a global pandemic. But the internet will be fun. New opportunities might arrive that make a Green New Deal easier to achieve. We might get that magic new technology that makes carbon neutral easier to get to. But what we shouldn't do is rely on them. That's something that has come out of a lot of government policy is wait, don't do anything. The magic bullet might arrive. All of the plans that we have put in can be done with current technology. We're not waiting for the magic solution. However, we should guard against changes that make things harder or make things worse. So we need to start thinking about policy now in terms of, does this bring us closer to or take us further away from the Green New Deal? So that's the plan. As I say, if you want to learn more about the Green New Deal aspect of this, then we have our blueprint, the Common Home Plan. It's on our website. It goes through all sectors of the economy in detail and what needs to change in each of them and what they'll look at once they have changed. Please go onto our policy library, download all of our policy papers there. And the last thing to say is Commonweal as an organisation is entirely funded by folk like yourself giving us a fiver or a tenner a month. We don't have the big money backers. We don't have rounds of fundraisers. We don't get government funding. We don't even have adverts on our website. It's entirely folk like yourselves who support Commonweal and our activities. So if you like what we've done, what we're continuing to do, you want us to see more of it, and you are able to help, then we deeply appreciate it. I know it's not an easy time for anyone. So that's the end. I'm happy to pass back over to our hosts and take some of your questions.
Thanks, Craig. That was huge. So much to take in. I have heard Robin talk about a lot of this, and I have to say I'm not finding it any easier the second time.
It's often hard enough to summarise one policy paper into a single talk. I've just done five, well, four in a book.
That one from Tony Young, who says, hopefully the new MSPs who replace the retiring MSPs will be open to your options. How can Commonweal gain access to these new people in the government? Tony also wants to know if you have digital versions of your publications available.
Yes, all the papers I mentioned today are freely available digitally on our policy library, commonweal.scot. Perhaps a more important question than how does Commonweal get access to MSPs is how do you get access to your MSP, because that's where the power is, really. Mm-hmm. It's constituents talking to their politicians. They are by far the most effective lobbyists in Scotland because MSPs have a duty to listen to their constituents. So if you like what we're doing, send your MSP a copy of our paper and say, why aren't we doing this? And if everybody does that, then you really start to ramp up the pressure. And we have had considerable success with this quite recently. A really good example would be actually the Labour Party is pushing a policy for rent controls at the moment. This is Pauline McNeill her Mary Barber bill. And it's very difficult for opposition members to get bills into Parliament. And the bill looked as if it wasn't going to make it to the next. It needed more signatures from MSPs to support it. It was actually Commonweal local group in Dundee found out about this and found people in the constituencies of all the MSPs in the Parliament and asked them to write to the MSP to support the bill. And they managed to get enough signatures for the bill to pass the stage. They actually managed to get a signature from an MSP of every single party, including the Conservatives, to sign up to this bill. And it made it to the next stage. Unfortunately, the planning committee then decided that because of the pandemic, there wasn't going to be enough time to discuss the bill before the next Parliament. So it looks as if it's probably going to be dropped. If it isn't discussed before the elections, then it'll fail completely and it'll have to be reintroduced. It'll go back to square one. But that example of constituents getting in touch with their MSPs and saying, why aren't we doing this? That's the best thing we can do. So it's an appeal to all of you. Send your MSPs a copy of the paper after the elections. Do it again.
Caroline and Keith want to know how we can close INEOS at Grangemouth and provide employment for the 10,000 people plus their dependents on the major plastic producer. How does FOE, that be Friends of the Earth, indicate how folk can be retrained into green jobs?
The Friends of the Earth paper I referenced looked specifically at the offshore industry rather than INEOS itself. But as we reconfigure our economy into a more circular, more sustainable economy, you are going to be seeing less plastic, you know, being produced and required. A lot of it can be changed into things like wood and hemp and, you know, other cloth-based materials and other more sustainable materials. Doesn't mean to say that there's no role for plastics, things like bioplastics, for instance. So there may still be a role for some sort of refining of biochemicals into materials like that. So the engineers at INEOS, even if it's not happening at Grangemouth, the talent and the skill there could be redeployed into similar sectors. This is why we need that diversification industry, to really look at those chains of translation for every type of job that will be affected by the Green New Deal.
Leah Gunn-Barrett also indicates here an excellent tool. This is a general statement, really, called writetothem.com. Yeah. That makes it very easy to identify and then write to your MSPs. I think we'll follow up on that at a later point.
Sean is the editor for our sister organisation, Source News. So he's also good if you have any stories about local initiatives that are happening in your area that are quite exciting, or if you have opinions about, you know, stuff that's happening in Scottish politics. Sean's a good person to talk to if you want to get a bit of a platform to write about things like that.
Mike Mollis then says, in support of what you said, plans are useless, planning's essential. Though the timetable and format of the developments will depend on events and political climate, can we all agree that the plan you've outlined may, and I would say will, prove invaluable? Okay?
I really hope so, although what I would say is we have a 25-year plan. We want to finish by 2045, but we're also now almost 9 months into 2020, so we're 9 months late already. Aye. So we need to get a move on.
Shall we call that a gestation period? Janet Bunganer said, education, how can we have a younger generation well informed in civil education, how our political systems work, basic economics, Scottish history and philosophy, how to think things through? So that's a wee address towards the education process. Any input on that, Craig?
Partly that's education, partly that'll be formal education. I would say that we are now living in an era where we have the entirety of human knowledge accessible through small supercomputers that we keep in our pockets. So there's a lot that we can do to teach ourselves. I would love to have a policy academy where we could be teaching people how to do politics and how to do policy development, which are two related but distinct things. So yeah, there's plenty of scope. But what I would say is, don't underestimate the knowledge of younger folk. Mm-hmm. If you saw the things like the climate strikes and the ongoing protests around social justice movements, folk are savvy. there's a lot of folk that, out there who know far more about whatever you think they need to know than is sometimes given credit for. So yeah, I've got hope. What I would say is let's not imply any ageism there either. There's plenty of older folk who are remarkably savvy as well.
Okay. Yvonne Keith asks, how will the number of jobs lost during the pandemic compare with the number of green jobs which will potentially become available in the future?
One of the things about the jobs plan, jobs numbers in the Green New Deal is it's less about, you know, where do we put the boots? It's how do we find the feet to fill them? It's we are looking at serious skill shortages as a result of the Green New Deal, which is the another reason to get going and get going fast, because we will very quickly exhaust the available labour pools, even after this recession. One of the projects that we're working on at the moment is what we can do to create even a pan-European training system to bootstrap up the skill levels that we'll need for the Green New Deal. Because one other thing is that we're all working in the same timetable on this. So we can't even say, well, we've got a shortage of plumbers, so let's just import a bunch of plumbers from Norway, for instance, because Norway is going to need those plumbers as well to do its Green New Deal stuff, as will Germany, as will France. So we need to be thinking internationally, we need to be cooperating on this.
Thank you. I like that very much indeed. Isabel Gow, who we all know, just comments, couple of interesting comments. She's a retired history and modern studies teacher. And she said she did a lot of this attempting to educate young folk and tell them about where they are and what they're doing and what our politics are about, including having hustings and mock elections. So it has been done before, and I see no reason why we shouldn't be asking for that from our MSPs, perhaps.
Even better than mock elections, let's start having elections. This is why we need better local democracy. We need democracy down at community level, because there's no better teacher than doing. So if we're actually doing local democracy in our communities, then that can prepare us for everything else.
Can Commonweal ever become a political party that we could all vote for?
Right. Think tanks and political parties both fulfil distinct and separate roles in politics. One of the advantages of being a politically neutral think tank is that we can approach all political parties and encourage all of them to take on some or as many as possible of our policies. You can't do that nearly so much if you are a political party. So I think there is still a valuable role for think tanks, especially think tanks at Commonweal, to be inputting into the political party process, but from the outside of it. That said, we do actively lobby all of the political parties who will listen to us, and we have activists within the parties who are trying to push Commonweal ideas inside their party. This is how we get a lot of our policies passed, as members of those parties bring them up at their party conferences. And we do have positive relationships with elected politicians. We've got a couple of them on our board. We've even seen a few of the prospective candidates in the elections. I'm not going to name names just because I don't want to endorse political candidates or parties in areas, but we have seen prospective candidates openly endorsing Commonweal and Commonweal ideas. So I think that's the right way of doing it. Of course, I'm going to say that from a think tank perspective. I want to see the parties endorse us rather than the other way around.
Absolutely. Good answer. David Mitchell then asks, as a starting point, how do we get a proper fiscal account for Scotland? Has anyone tried or failed to get this from HMRC?
Right, back in 2016, it's because JERS is coming out tomorrow. It's my busiest day of the year and not always the the most inspiring. Back in 2016, I produced a paper called Beyond Jers, which tried to do this, tried to look at what the prospective day one independence budget for Scotland would be. That paper isn't directly comparable now because there have been a lot of very significant changes to the way things like the block grant and the fiscal framework work in Scotland. So that work does need to be done again. The previous Economy Secretary, Derek Mackay, did have plans to produce this notional independence budget to publish it alongside JERS. And Kate Forbes, when she took over that job, did say at least once that that plan was still on the cards, but I haven't heard anything since, and I haven't heard anything in the run-up to tomorrow. Maybe we'll be surprised by that notional independence budget coming out, but I don't know. I genuinely have not heard either way. I'd like to think that it's still on the cards and it hasn't been bumped because of COVID.
Mike Wallace, I'll put two things together here. He's mentioned that you, I think, touched on the question of a national care service. He just tells us, he's telling the membership, in actual fact, a bit of free advertising here, young Wallace, that there'll be a chat at the Yes Hub on Friday at 6:30 on the National Care Service with Colin Fox. So I've done the plug. That's a favour you owe me, young Mike.
And we're actively researching this. We're going to be producing a paper on the principles that a National Care Service should cover, and we're going to follow that up with a more detailed implementation plan. Keep an eye on the website, keep an eye on Commonweal.
Thank you. That's great. Does Commonweal have any plans to curtail on massively reduced tax advertising and the rich beneficiaries of advertising to end our consumerist society? Right, James, you're on the red wine again.
I can go a bit better than that. If you're aware of the tax expert Richard Murphy, Professor Richard Murphy, he wrote a paper for us a wee while ago on the principles of a Scottish tax system for an independent Scotland. Mm-hmm. So it's a long and it's a detailed technical paper. But if you're asking that kind of question, you're already up for reading that paper. Please go and do so. I should also say that we're also in the process in very late stage of looking at papers around wealth and land taxation.
Okay, Mark D says this is a really exciting, positive vision for the future. But how do we share it with the wider Scottish population, particularly those who rely on the mainstream media, such as the BBC and the papers, to inform their opinions? That's a real task and a strider for you, isn't it?
We might be physically distancing at the moment, but the last thing we should be doing is socially distancing. So talk to your friends, talk to your family, bring this up in conversation, especially the ones who aren't avidly watching the Commonweal website. Just as you're talking to your politicians, talk to your friends and family about this. Find out what their issues are, what are the issues that matter to them. And then use that to show how the ideas that you hold dear can improve that situation, can help them. That's often the best way into these conversations.
Thanks very much, Craig. That's excellent. One of the things that I've been able to do while we've been in this lockdown is to increase my blether quotient with people we're bumping into in the street, because for the first 7 or 8 weeks at least, people were very approachable. Hello, how are you? You're dealing with COVID today, and then lead into a conversation about the future, et cetera, et cetera. And I've met a number of Tories, but I met an awful lot more folk who weren't any conservative than I look and were happy to talk about the future for Scotland. So as you say, you never give up. There's always a way. I think we've one more question coming.
Actually, there's one question I'd like to ask, and it is slightly political and it can be cut out, that's fine. But is there any way that you can get the ear of the Scottish Government? I'm sure you're trying, and I appreciate it's really difficult, but they really need to hear all these things and take them on board.
As I say, our biggest successes come when it's not us doing the talking, but you.
But us, yeah. You did say that, yeah.
So, So First Minister did acknowledge, for example, our influence in the Scottish National Investment Bank process. That was a policy that was initiated by Commonweal. We often find that talking to the government, making them aware of it, talking to things like civil servants and other stakeholders to find out just what is possible within that policy, that then opens up the permission to do something. You don't have that barrier of, well, civil servant said no. And then getting the grassroots to say, we want that, to generate the demand. That's when things start happening.
Yeah.
Okay, well,
but yeah, it needs different people talking at every level.
Okay. We'll send out the demand for that from the membership. Neil McInnes says on Mark D's question on reaching the wider population, he mentions Richard Murphy has started a series of short 5-minute videos talking straight to camera. You're obviously comfortable doing that, said he, chipping in. you at Commonweal would
that be something you know, actually, talking to camera rather than talking to a person is the least comfortable that I am. If you look at some of those times that I have done it, for example, our currency campaign, I end up looking terrified because I am terrified talking just talking to camera. But that said, just before lockdown started, we actually were discussing plans to do the 5-minute shorts for policies, but also to do an extensive lecture series, you know, me talking about something for, you know, half an hour or an hour, as I've done today, and then putting them up as a longer watch series. What I would say, though, is we also have, Commonwealth does have a policy podcast every Wednesday. Myself and our campaigns officer, Jonathan Chaffee, sit down and blether for half an hour on whatever takes our fancy that week. So you can, again, go on our website. You can get all the episodes there. If you're on any of the podcast aggregators, Spotify, Apple Music, Google Play, whatever, other podcast aggregators are available, as they say. If you search for the Commonweal Policy Podcast, you'll get it there. There's already almost 40 hours worth of material there to listen to. And as I say, every Wednesday we put out a new episode.
Does Commonweal have a view on what Scottish defence system should look like?
Yes, we've published a couple of papers on this, actually.
Ah, right.
So, first principle, non-nuclear. We need to get those nuclear weapons out of Scotland as quickly as possible, and we even have strong opinions against Faslane being rented as a nuclear base on a temporary basis, because those kind of temporary leases almost always become permanent leases. Either it'll be so cheap, the rent will be so cheap that Westminster just won't have an incentive to build a new base somewhere, or the rent will be so high that the Scottish Government then becomes dependent on the revenue and doesn't want the nukes to go. And it's a very fine line between the two. So we want them out as quickly as possible. We do have a couple of policy papers in our library that go into the principles of a Scottish defence system. So rather than summarise it here, I'll let you go and dig that out.
Thanks, Craig. That's great. We have the good fortune where we're sitting just now to be 10 miles as the crow flies from Rosyth. And not everyone's aware that there are 8 nuclear submarines sitting there waiting to be decommissioned. Are slowly rotting, and the government in Westminster will do sweet nothing about it.
Come independence and negotiations over our share of debts and assets, that is going to be one of the things I would like to see on the table.
Ellen Hoffer says, the only thing that gets through to the Scottish government is pressure from membership and voters, and that's as it should be. It's not like ScotGov isn't watching those Commonweal types like hawks, as we would expect.
One thing I'd love to say, just to Ellen's comment, is she's heard me say this before, is that I think everything in politics is impossible until it becomes inevitable. Uh-huh. As soon as that pressure hits a tipping point, things happen, and you look back and you think, well, how could it have ever been anything else?
That's it.
A really good reminder. Thanks, Craig. Yeah, we all need to try harder in that respect. Okay. With you here. Some really great questions, I have to say. Thanks, everybody, and really good answers, Craig. And
thanks very much.
Yeah. And just to everybody else, go onto our website, commonweal.scot. Go through our stuff. We've got the policy library. We've got the podcast. We've got a bunch of other material there. If you want to get involved, we're currently looking for volunteers. So if you go onto our Do Something page, you can find out what you can do, or you can suggest what you can do, which is always even better. Right. And very last thing, as I say, if you're not already a supporter and you're able to support us and you want to support us, then any other think tank in Scotland, it's folk like yourselves who keep us going. So if you can help us out, please, please do.
You've been listening to an event organised by Edinburgh and Lothian's Pensioners for Independence group, in which Craig Dalziel, Head of Research at Commonweal Think Tank, described Commonweal's plans to create a resilient Scottish economy. You can find out more about Pensioners for Independence on our website, pensionersforindependence.scot. There are about a dozen Pensioners for Indy groups around Scotland. If you'd like to become active with us, please contact any of those groups or contact us through the form on the website.